Talk given Saturday, 10th February 1973. As I have already said, this is our 11th anniversary. And as practically all of you know, these groups were started for the sake of the study of the essence of religion and the nature and practice of meditation. The study of the essence of religion in order particularly that one may understand what was the background against which the Buddha and Buddhism arose. And we have tried to look very considerably, of course, into the Buddhist teachings and also into some of the Brahmanical teachings, mainly, therefore, the Veda and the Upanishad, during these years. Only recently have we started a really serious consideration of the Rig Veda, and we will be going on from next time, I expect, into the Upanishads. At our last meeting, we touched upon something which is the very climax of the whole of the religious life. The meaning of the realization of immortality. As we all know, whatsoever is born necessarily dies. Because whatsoever comes into being as a finite, limited thing or creature is compounded of various elements that make up its or his being. And this compounding uncompounds through the passage of time. And so there is death. We use lovely phrases sometimes. They are very convenient, they are very inspiring. And they have their meaning, significance in their own context. We talk of the eternal hills or the eternal stars and so forth. Relatively to us, and in a rough and ready sense, they are eternal. But they too are perpetually transforming and uncompounding. Because of which they totally lose anything like unchanging identity. So that in fact, all our experience, all our knowledge, everything points to the fact that there is no such thing as this changeless, immortal entity that man arrogates to himself. None of the other kingdoms of nature carry out any such arrogation to themselves, simply because, of course, they haven't got the ability to. We alone, because of our thinking and desiring and the way our senses and mind function, can make such an assertion. And last time, we looked into this tremendous conflict, therefore, that in actual fact, there is no such thing as the survival of an eternal entity, an immortal soul or spirit or whatever you like to call it, in the sense of a finite, particular, individual soul or spirit. There is no such thing as that sort of spirit or soul being eternal. And at the same time, all the great religions of the world have unequivocally affirmed immortality and shown the ways and means for the realization by the individual, as they say, here now, of immortality. And with this immortality, they have associated, without wavering at all as regards the positivity of that affirmation, they have associated bliss and the supreme fulfillment of man. Man's happiness in the true sense of the word. Not in a mythical heaven hereafter, but here and now whilst we live. So obviously, there is a conflict between the two. This very positive affirmation, without any reservation, an unconditional affirmation of immortality, happiness, bliss on the one hand, for us here and now, and on the other hand, the equally unequivocal affirmation, not in a good many of the theistic religions, true enough, perhaps in all of them, but in all the profound and deep religious teachings and philosophies, there is also the unequivocal affirmation that that which is here, the finite, the particular, do remember that always, is not an immortal, unchanging, eternally identifiable entity. And last time we tried to look into this and understand what is the meaning then of immortality. Let me just recall one or two of the essential points. The whole question hinges round the manner in which you and I are aware, are conscious of our daily existence. We have our various senses, and these senses are the avenues, the windows, if you like, through which impressions, sense impressions, are made upon us. We receive these impressions, the brain coordinates them together, synthesizes them, makes a thought structure of them all. This is how we come to know the world. And this thought structure is composed of an endless stream of words. Every single word represents a thing or a person. It represents actions, relationships, degrees, good, better, best, that sort of thing, you see, and so forth. This is what the words represent. And we are conscious of our existence in terms of words, mainly of words, sometimes of a series of pictures. But the recognizability of those pictures or a succession of sounds always gets referred back to the word. We say, oh, I see a series of pictures, but you can name everything, otherwise you don't know the picture. The knowing of the picture is the naming of the picture, and that means the words. The words. And since every word represents something which is only finite, limited, and particular, therefore something which comes into being, develops or grows, lives and dies, We are therefore conscious of our existence in the mode of mortality. This is due to the fact that we are constituted as we are. This is how we are made. Now, the point is that although this is how it appears to us that we are made, we are not yet sufficiently aware of what lies dormant in us, waiting for development and growth. There are depths of mind and consciousness associated with mind, which are completely dormant in us, and which only await the urge from within, the interest, and the real urge from within to release these faculties, and also one has to await the suitability of the particular circumstance in which one is. If the circumstances are completely unfavorable, we cannot pursue this. We cannot let these faculties of the mind, which lie within us, develop. Now, through the ages, there have been those who did do this. And what happened was that they became conscious, they became aware of this same world in which you and I live in a totally different manner. As I said, we are aware in terms of words, therefore in terms of limitation, finitude, therefore in terms of death. But if the sense functions are allowed to become still, if one penetrates into all the conditioning of the mind which compels us to interpret all our everyday passing sense life in terms of mortality, if we get free of that conditioning, this new awareness emerges. The stream of words stops. And that doesn't mean that life stops. Far from it. Life in its wholeness, its totality goes on. But we now are aware of life and of conscious and are conscious of existence. Now consider the mode of being conscious in terms of beginning, proceeding, ending, of birth, death, as we call it, has been transcended. We are awake. We are conscious. And if the mode of mortality has been transcended and you are fully awake, in what mode are you conscious? Whatever other qualities there may be associated with that mode of consciousness, at least it is the non-mortal mode. It is the immortal mode of awareness. And this is what you and I can experience, realize, and live in here and now. And here is the meaning, the real living meaning of immortality. This is what they experienced, realized, and they lived in consonance with that inward realization, which meant that their life was totally altered. It was a life wherein confusion, ignorance, conflict, ambivalence, evil, all that suffering, all that dukkha, which is the real dukkha that the Buddha talked of, was out of their lives. See, we really must penetrate into this, because this lies at the very, very heart of the understanding, of the fruition of the religious life, and the emergence into full light of the religious consciousness, the religious awareness, the transcendent awareness of our existence. The affairs of the world went on just the same as before, but they were different. The people were different. And this is how you and I can be different. Physically, of course, pleasure and pain, the pleasant situation, the unpleasant situation, the experience which is physically agreeable and the experience which is physically very disagreeable and painful, all that will come whether you're God Almighty or any old miserable sinner. Makes no difference. That will come physically as such. But you will be conscious and live totally differently. And this is the important thing to bear in mind. This transformation of one's own self. Now, with this transformation of one's self, one lives the truly human life, not subhuman. One's life is pure. What we commonly call the virtues are there in apotheosis. They are transcendently present. What we call enlightenment, understanding, compassion, they are all operative fully and completely, without let or hindrance. This is what we mean by the perfected Holy One. The founders of the religions were people of that nature. And they realized from their own living experience, their continuous state of realization, that as and when human beings changed themselves in this manner, all the ordinary misery and suffering of life would disappear. Why? Because they saw with absolute clarity, with simple clarity, that the conditions of life, apart from those which nature imposes upon us, and we are helpless before those conditions, apart from that, everything that happens in our life is the result of the interaction between the inanimate environment, and as well as the animate environment, trees and animals and so forth, and ourselves. If we change, the way we interact, the way we respond to the external world is completely different. What the world needs is not changing its systems which are already existent, because those systems are ourselves. The evils of society or whatever it is are my evils in actual manifestation. If I change, then I do not contribute to greater evil in the world. We don't know for certain precisely what words the Buddha used, but the Buddhist texts constantly talk of the escape from evil, the escape from the ill state. Escape, I feel, is a bad word to use in the context. I feel that what would be nearer the truth would be to say that one ceases to be a producer, a maintainer, a perpetuator of the ill state. And if that is the case, whatsoever comes out of one's own living and being is something which makes for the well-being in the true sense of man, for the fruition, his happiness, and the fulfillment of the purpose of his existence in this world for man. This is why this question of immortality is so very important. And it is not a question which can be understood, for which we can get an answer in terms of a philosophical system. Any philosophical system is a thought structure, a word structure. So long as thought is the living, immediate expression in the now, here and now, of the functioning of one's own living intelligence, well and good. The thoughts come out. They are expressed. I'll use a word which is not very pleasant, perhaps, but which is very true. We excrete our thoughts out of our minds. Systems of thought are excretions. They are the excreta of the mind. They are a necessary process. Man must necessarily function that way, putting out thought, putting out words, ideas, and so forth, because his living process is of that nature. But when he collects what he has excreted and makes a house of it, it's not exactly a very pleasant house to live in. And that is just what we are experiencing in our lives and have experienced through, what, a couple of million years? Or whatever it is. So you see, the thought structure, the verbal structure, must be treated as the passing thing. Let it go. Don't be concerned with that. If our living process is one where there is simple, perfect purity, where there is unselfness, where there is real attentiveness to our whole life, here and now, free of all our false idealisms, our preconceptions, our assumptions, and above all, free of our greeds and resentments and our dreadful, tragic delusions and illusions, then what can life be but perfect and happy? So this transformation of our mode of awareness of existence sums up, that single sentence I believe can sum up, the whole of the religious endeavor, the religious life. And I'm going to cut out the adjective religious and say the whole of human endeavor and human living. This complete transformation of the mode of awareness of existence. I have, to a considerable extent, repeated what we dealt with the previous fortnight. But this is so important, and it is, as far as I can see, so much right at the heart of the whole thing, that it could bear repetition over and over again. We must get the idea quite clear in our minds. But don't let the idea become a fixed idea. The letting of the idea become clear means that your living mind, your living intelligence, is getting freer and freer of all the illusions, the delusions, the misconcepts with which it is cluttered up. And once that livingness, that quality of livingness, really animates your whole mind, your whole being, your whole awareness, you will be the human being. Until then, until I do that, I am just a subhuman being. Do be tremendously sensitive to this. What do we do in the ordinary way throughout our lives? We pursue pleasure, happiness as we call it. We pursue success as we call it. We pursue love as we call it. All for ourselves. Let us make no mistake about it. We are completely self-oriented. We try to take out of the universe everything that we would like to and want to and which we can compel to come to us and gorge upon it under the extraordinary delusion that, oh, this is good living, real happiness, and what a fine fellow I am. This is precisely what we do, isn't it? We rake up memory, our memory of the past. We rake up our acquired knowledge of history and this, that, and the other, and say that in such and such a circumstance, so and so did this, that, and the other, and lo and behold, what a wonderful time they had, and what success they had, and all the rest of it. And what happens to the whole lot? Into the maw of death. The Lord of Death swallows us all. And in the being swallowed, there is the pain, the terror, and the torture of hell. A state of mind. Hell is a state of mind. And it is there with us. And we never, never see that we ourselves, I myself, am the producer of that. I am the one who gives life to the Lord of Death. We don't see it. Now, when we begin to see this sort of thing, sit back and let go all our preconceptions, all the ideas that have been put into us. Let go of the dominating influence of our sensations upon our mind. The mind gets caught up by the pleasant sensations and gives birth to all sorts of false ideas about life and human fulfillment. Use the conventional Buddhist formulation: if we can let go of greed, of violence, of delusion, and so forth, of hate, jealousy, envy, ambition, all the misconceptions about self and not self and all the rest of it. If we can get free of this fundamental source of sorrow in life, the duality between self and not self. If we do that, then that which truly constitutes us, mentally particularly, is free to manifest itself. And what is it that constitutes us? Happiness? Health? Well-being? Purity? Wisdom? Intelligence? Love? Truth? Beauty? Goodness? The whole lot. That's what actually constitutes us. and we spoil our constitution. We make ourselves ill by the misfortune of our own ignorance to start with, and the misfortune of the conditioning we must of necessity suffer because of parents, teachers, friends, our society, and all the rest of it. Of course, one has to be strong to question everything. And we must question in the right way, not in the destructive spirit, not as mere rebellion against anybody else. We all see this phenomenon. Every generation criticizes its parents, the elders, and say, "You've made a mess of the world." And every generation succeeds very often much better than its parents did in producing a world which is even worse than ever before, and far more terrible and awful. Why? How? Because our rebellion is of the wrong sort. It is not a rebellion against that we want, because that is violence. And violence only means that which produces disruption, unprofitably, unwise disruption. It is not like the action of the skilled farmer, the skilled gardener, who will weed the meadow, who will dig up the soil, and so on and so on, do all the necessary intelligent things, prepare the ground, then sow the seed and reap a crop. That is not violent rebellion against what one feels is not right. But we all do that. Note the different systems of philosophy which have come up, particularly politically. All these violent reactions against the old order. And what do they produce? Even more disorder generally. It's happening in our own lifetime and has been happening for years just over the seas. Just violence, disorder. It won't do any good. Violence breeds violence. Fear, suspicion, hate breed fear, suspicion, hate. So that's not the way to question what is. We must question not in the spirit of reaction, but with a completely open mind, ready to be able to understand. Now, what is the actual fact of the matter? If we do that, if we try to do that, we will make one of the most valuable practical discoveries where our own living process is concerned. Namely, who is the person who is examining what is? What sort of a person is he? Is he capable of such examination? And then I turned round upon myself and say, "Oh, heavens alive, I've been criticizing the situation. And I say that this is so and this is so. I make these magnificent authoritarian statements with regal gestures. But do I know? Am I free from the evil, the conflict, the misery, the confusion which I am criticizing? I myself am like that." Now one begins to see real light. I say real light because now there is a chink in one's own being, horribly encrusted with evil. Through that chink, light comes in and a transformation process takes place from within. This person is all the evil which he criticizes. I myself am that evil. See? When I really see that, not as a brilliant logical intellectual deduction, but that inner sensitivity within me is wholly awake to it, then I know it in the manner in which a person, when he really has a flash of true insight, says, oh, of course, it's that. That of course-ness comes into the situation from within. And it is from there that something pure and clean and with the power for perfecting and beautifying begins to emerge and changes oneself first and foremost, and inevitably the environment feels the effect of it. Now when I do that, or when I can do that, I have ceased to invade my environment with my ideas and to impose them violently, inconsiderately, impatiently upon others. It's so easy for us to rush about trying to convince the other person of our viewpoint, isn't it? Don't we take immense delight in doing that? We can't go about brandishing spears and swords and slaying the enemy physically. Therefore, now we have turned to this kind of warfare, intellectual warfare, intellectual violence, convincing the other fellow. No, leave the other fellow alone. He's a good chap. Perhaps he's better than I am. Actually, if I only knew. Let me come to know him. Really come to know him. As he actually is from moment to moment. Not as he was 20 years ago. Or that particular speech he made on the platform and made an awful fool of himself or something like that. But as he is here and now, the living being. And if I'm open to him like that, then there is this mystery and this omnipotent transforming power of true love come into being. Because where I don't impose the self upon anybody, I am loving that body. Think this out in connection with love between man and man, between man and wife, parent and child, friend and friend, stranger and stranger. Think this out. When I have ceased to impose the self upon anybody, then I have ceased to do violence to him. So you see, all the means by which life can be really beautified, and by which the finest and the best can be realized from within ourselves, by ourselves, by which immortality itself and that blissful state of perfect poise within, which is unshakable poise, all this can come into being. And with it, a world in which man lives as man. His every expression, his every action, his every thought, and his every feeling is one through which transcendent virtue completely expresses itself. Completely expresses itself. And it is that transcendent virtue which it is man's prerogative to call forth, to release from within himself in response to the universal transcendent virtue and express it in everyday life, remaking this world into a veritable Garden of Eden again.